This is the fourth day of this November 2010 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text, The Practice of Zen, translated by C.C. Chang. The previous 3 days of Sesshin, we spent reading the autobiography of Master Hanshan, and now we're going to read a section of his own teaching. And you may be surprised at how different this is from his autobiography. His autobiography is full of marvels and extraordinary things, and it's a little almost hard to believe that chronicle is the same person who wrote this this very straight up, clean, kind of orthodox Zen teaching. So we'll just go into it now. It's called Discourse of Master Hanshan. Concerning this great matter, the Tao, everyone has possessed it from the beginning. It is always with each of you. The difficulty is that from the very no beginning time, the wonderful illumination has been covered over by seeds of passion, streams of thought, the flow of conceptualization, and deeply rooted habitual thinking. This phrase, the no beginning time, is one that we find in Buddhist texts here and there. It points to the dual nature of time, that in one sense we can see it as this linear phenomenon, but on the with a beginning and an end. But on the other hand, time is a construct of the human mind. And when we detach from that notion of past or beginnings or endings and so forth, then we're beyond time. We can't speak of a beginning or an end. So then from the very no beginning time, this Buddha mind has been covered over by seeds of passion. This would be the blind passions that we refer to in the four vows, streams of thought. Well, we're on familiar terms with those. The flow of conceptualization, ditto, and deeply rooted habitual thinking, ditto. Therefore, we have never been able to grasp the actual realization itself, but instead have wandered among the shadows of delusory thoughts about mind, body, and the world. This is why we have been ever roaming in samsara. The shadows of delusory thoughts about mind, body, and the world. Or in English terms, thoughts about I, me, my, the world as some notion of, the notion of a world as something apart from us. The delusory thoughts about things, self and things. Besides just plain old the I and the me and the my, in Sesshin it's so much my practice. People can waste so much time thinking about my practice, which is a thought. There's the doing of the practice, olemu, or the breathing, what, who. There's the actual doing of it, and then there are thoughts about my practice. And I think many people aren't aware of how much, are often not aware of when they're thinking about my practice. My practice is good, my practice is bad, my practice is better, my practice is worse, my practice is this or that. Part of actual practice is noticing when we have drifted into ideas about practice, and then bringing the mind back to the thing itself. This is why we have been ever roaming in samsara. From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. He goes on, previously, the Buddhas and patriarchs who incarnated in this world through the use of thousands of words and various methods taught either the doctrine or Zen. And the doctrine refers to all of the different schools of Buddhism other than Zen. All their teachings were nothing but instruments to crush the habitual clingings infecting human thought. Clinging is an especially good word to summarize what we're up against in Zen practice, what the basic problem is, the problem of our human habit of clinging, above all, clinging to thoughts. Habitual clingings infecting human thought. There is no Dharma in the sense of something real or concrete in that which they have handed down to us. The so-called practice or work is merely a method for purifying the shadows of our habitual thinking and flowing thoughts. To concentrate all one's efforts to this end is called work. If suddenly the surging thoughts stop, one clearly sees that his self-mind is originally pure, genuine, vast, illuminating, perfect, and devoid of objects. This is called enlightenment. There is nothing outside of the mind, nothing which can be worked upon, and nothing to be enlightened. However, the egotistic passions, long accumulated and rooted within us, are difficult to wipe out. Don't we know that? There is nothing outside of the mind. Nothing apart from us to be worked on, and not even anything or anyone to be enlightened. And this is the teaching of shunyata, no thingness, emptiness. And what he said, there is no Dharma in the sense of something real or concrete. This is so hard for us to grasp. Because as soon as we give it a word, Dharma, then almost inevitably it becomes a thing in the mind. But this is the great paradox, is that this teaching is a no teaching. Dharma is just things as they are. The law, the basis of reality itself. The great Zhao Zhou was once asked, what is the teaching in the distant mountains where no one is present? You could say, what is the Dharma in the remote mountains? And Zhao Zhou said, large rocks are large, small rocks are small. The egotistic passions cravings, long accumulated and rooted within us, are difficult to wipe out. These passions have been compared to the stains in a table. There are the surface stains, and there are the more deeply ingrained stains. Fortunately, in this lifetime, through the help and instruction of right teachers, the prajna seed within you has had an opportunity to grow. Prajna means wisdom, transcendental wisdom. Thus your spiritual aspirations and your determination have been awakened. But you must realize that it is not easy to pull out all at once the roots of samsara, which have been deeply embedded within you from beginningless time. This task is not trivial. Only those of will and might, brave enough to shoulder such a burden and to press straight forward without the slightest hesitation or timidity, will be able to enter into it. To the way. An old proverb says, this matter is like one person against 10,000 enemies. How true this is. Generally speaking, at this time, when the Dharma is in a state of degeneration, there are many who practice the way, but few of them can come to actual realization. Gropers and hard workers are many, but beneficiaries and finders of the path remain few. Why? This is because most practitioners do not know how to work, how to enter into the task at the very outset. What they do instead is to fill their minds with the words and ideas that they have formed through thinking, or they measure things by means of the discriminating mind, or they suppress the stream of thought, or dazzle themselves with visionary bewilderments. He ought to know. Some of them have stuffed themselves with the mysterious words of the old masters and treated these instructions or understandings as their own. They do not know that all these things are useless. This is what is meant by the saying, to acquire understanding at the hands of others is to close the gate of self-enlightenment. This was a big problem in Hanshan's time, this tendency to, as he says it, stuff themselves with the words of the old masters. There is such a great, so much value placed on memorizing in ancient China, maybe even to some extent today, but especially then, to memorize the words of Confucius and other sages, the masters, and then this could become a source of pride, the way one could spout these words to others. This reference to the Dharma is in a state of, at this time when the Dharma is in a state of degeneration. There's a footnote here that can sum this up neatly. Supposedly the Buddha himself prophesies that that the Dharma will decline with the degeneration of morality in humankind. According to the Buddha's prophecy, the progressive decline and degeneration of the Dharma will continue until it disappears from the earth. Then the Buddha Maitreya will descend to this world, and the Dharma will again prevail, this time over the entire earth. The Dharma of the next period, that of the Buddha Maitreya, will not be subject to the decline pattern that the Dharma of this present period is now undergoing. Well, having heard that, you're all urged to forget about it. It doesn't really have anything to do with us. We have our work. We have our own egotistic passions, long accumulated and rooted within us, and that's all we need to tackle, not think in terms of then and now and in the future. This warning, what they do is to fill their minds with the words and ideas that they have formed through thinking. This is something that is going on all the time in our minds, whether we're aware of it or not. Probably few people are aware of it as it's going on. They measure things by means of the discriminating mind. This is a big one. We so reflexively make discriminations into this and that. And this also is part of practice, is catching ourselves, realizing that we're doing it. Anytime there's two-ness in the mind, then we've missed it. We're not there. People often come to Dokusan with questions that have to do with, is it better to do this or better to do that? Is this right or is that right? And this is a way to get snagged in one's practice. The practice of working on a koan or breath practice is incredibly simple. Not easy, but simple, uncomplicated. There is no need to discriminate. If your practice is mu, it means just mu, just the word mu. Nothing else, nothing extra. Nothing more than that. The reason that's so difficult is because of our tendency to complicate things. We can't believe that it really is just mu. Mu. We keep complicating it with this discriminating mind. Same with the breath. it's hard to buy that all we have to do is merge with the breath. That's it. We don't have to figure anything out. We don't have to strategize or make decisions. It's just the breath. It's just mu. It's just what? Who? In the case of Shikantaza, it's just. We complicate the practice by weaving thoughts in and out, allowing the mind to wander into past and future and other places. And above all, by bringing in thoughts of self and other. It's all extra. Unnecessary. He goes on, the first step you should take in Zen work is to forget about all understanding and knowledge and concentrate on one thought. Well, we said yesterday this could be the nub of one's koan or the breath. In other words, what he's saying is focus the mind. Become single-minded. Firmly believe that your self-mind, or you say your self-nature, is originally pure and clear without the slightest trace of any existence, bright, perfect, and ubiquitous throughout the entire universe. From the beginning, there was no body, mind, or world, nor any erroneous thoughts or infective passions. Right at this instant, the appearance of this one mind is in reality non-existent. All manifestations before my eyes are also delusions devoid of substance. They are merely shadows within the mind. Again here, he is going right to the very core of the experience of awakening and revealing the no-thingness of all things. They're all shadows. Everything is in the mind is shadows. Other than the pure absorption in the practice. With this definite understanding, one should then search out the point where your thoughts arise and disappear. See where a thought arises and where it vanishes. This is a practice he was recommending at that time. It's not one that we do here, but it's another way to reach this realm of no mind that the koan and the breath practice and so forth will lead us to. Keep this point in mind and try to break right through it. Try to crush it with all your might. If you can crush it to pieces, all will dissolve and vanish away. Well, we can use the same language in terms of koan work, is to crush and dissolve the koan. That's one way to do it. It's not the only way. There are other ways of approaching the koan, more of embracing, melting into the koan. It's all for the purpose of awakening to the fact that the koan is not an object apart from us as a subject. It's all a matter of getting beyond two-ness. the practice as object and self as subject. Master Yung Chia once warned, the thought of continuation should be cut short. He's referring to thoughts, trains of thought. This is because floating, delusory thoughts are rootless and unreal. Never treat the distracted thought as a concrete thing. When it arises, notice it right away, but never try to suppress it. Let it go and watch it as one watches a gourd floating on the surface of a stream. This is just standard instruction in Zen practice, not suppressing our thoughts. Just leave them alone. There's nothing we need to do with our thoughts. Just need to keep returning our attention to the practice. What you should do is take up this awareness as if holding a sharp sword in your hand. No matter whether Buddha or devils come, just cut them off like a snarl of entangled silk threads. Use all your attention and strength patiently to push your mind to the very dead end of consciousness. Just push it on and on. This should not be confused with straining. We don't want to strain. That is really just, it doesn't work. Pushing the mind on and on means just maintaining this attention, this meticulous attention to the practice, and persisting with that. Those who determine to practice the Dharma should believe firmly the teaching of mind only. The Buddha said, all the three kingdoms are mind. All 10,000 dharmas are consciousness. The three kingdoms or the three worlds are just a way of referring to all phenomena. All conceivable phenomena are the worlds of desire, the world of form without desire, and the world of formlessness. All of them, all the 10,000 things, the million, billion things, are consciousness, our own consciousness. And he says, all Buddhism is nothing but an exposition of this sentence. Ignorance or enlightenment, virtue or evil, cause or effect are nothing but one's own mind. Not one iota of anything exists outside of mind. The Zen practitioner should completely cast aside his former knowledge and understandings. Here, scholarship or cleverness is useless. Rather, he should look on the whole world as hallucinatory. What he sees are mirages, mirror images, like the moon reflected in the water. The sounds he hears are hymns of the wind blowing through the trees. He should see all manifestations as clouds floating in the sky, changing and unreal. Not only the outer world, but all habitual thoughts, passions, distractions, and desires within one's own mind are likewise insubstantial, non-concrete, rootless, and floating. If you can practice like this, you will be doing some solid work. Well, this is where Kensho is so helpful, because it reveals what he's saying, and we don't have to take it on faith. From then on, we can more easily see all obstructions, the blind passions, defilements, and so forth, all as truly empty, shadow-like, phantom-like. And this is enormously helpful in not getting caught in them. There are many koans which help you to work in the tumult of worldly activities, like the one, "Who is it who recites the name of Buddha?" Or you could say just, "Who am I? What am I? What is it?" Although this koan is most helpful, you must realize that it is merely a stone for knocking upon the door. When the door is opened, the stone is thrown away. To work on a koan, you must have firmness, unshakable determination, and solid perseverance. You should not have the least hesitation or irresolution, nor should you practice one koan today and another one tomorrow. You should not entertain any doubts about attaining enlightenment, nor about the koan being too deep or mysterious, and so on. All such thoughts are hindrances. Well, so is the thought of enlightenment itself. He says, don't entertain any doubts about attaining enlightenment, but don't have any thoughts about it either. That's also obstructive. I point them out to you now so that you will notice them later when they come up. When your work is being done well, things in the outer world will not bother you very much. But the trouble is that mental disturbances will arise feverishly in your mind without any obvious reason. Sometimes desires and lust well up. Sometimes an indescribable restlessness bursts forth. Numerous other hindrances will also appear. All these difficulties will tire you mentally and physically so that you will not know what to do. You must then realize that all these harassing experiences are produced by your meditation effort, which has stimulated into activity the seeds of habit deeply hidden in your store consciousness from the very no beginning time. So this is a crucial point he's making, that when we find ourselves suddenly blindsided by some train of thought or some strong emotion or feeling, that these are the side effects of our strong effort. And we must never despair when that happens. It's one of the most common experiences to, after a period of relative ease in one's practice where things are finally seem to be flowing and thoughts are not much of a problem, to suddenly we get clobbered by one kind of hindrance or another. We have to when that happens, rather than just feeling alarm or frustration, just to have the presence of mind to recognize it's just another side effect of strong exertion. These things come up. That's what happens in practice. If nothing ever comes up, then the practice is probably, well, it could be either extremely advanced when these things don't aren't a problem anymore, or one is just using practice as a kind of relaxation method. Then we're not likely to have these things. But in Sesshin, they're more likely to happen. At this crucial stage, you must recognize them thoroughly and break through them. Never take them as real. Never subject yourself to their control and deceptions. What you should do is to refresh your mind, alert yourself, and with a high spirit, look right at the arising point of the distracting thought. Look into its very bottom. Push your mind on and on to the impenetrable state. Say to yourself, "There is no such thing in me. Where do you come from?" In this manner, exert your mind to the very, very end. Wipe out all traces of thoughts. Kill them and make all the deities and ghosts cry out. If you work like this, the good news will come soon to you. If you can break one thought into pieces, all thoughts will instantaneously be stripped off. This will be like the emergence of a clear, limpid pond when the mists have vanished. Another way to say this is when we become aware that we're in the grip of a thought, is to just to remind ourselves that it is just a passing phenomenon. It's just a little transitory event. It may hang on longer than we want it to, but it'll pass. There's no reason to get discouraged when we find ourselves caught in one of these things. After this stage, you will feel comfortable and infinitely light, filled with boundless joy. But this is just the beginning of knowing how to work. There's nothing wonderful about it. Never rejoice and wallow in this ravishing experience. If you do, the devil of joy will possess you. Those whose hindrances are too great, whose seeds of passion are too strong, and whose habitual thoughts are too inveterately rooted in their store consciousness, not knowing how to observe their minds or how to work on the koan, should practice prostrations before Buddha, recite sutras, and do repentance. Well, these things can be supportive practices, supportive to the Zazen. They definitely can be. In Korean Zen, you start each day with doing 108 prostrations, and then you do your sitting. These things have a the prostrations and also repentance have a power that may seem surprising until we've actually done them. Beginners or people without any kind of devotional feeling might be skeptical that prostrations can have much effect, but they can. They can open the mind, can open the heart. They can, after all, what are prostrations? They're a way to, as Roshi Kapoor used to say, to horizontalize the mast of ego in an experiential way, a way that involves actually embodying that, not thinking about what a problem the ego is and how we should be more humble, but by doing it, physically doing the prostrations, this is a way to reduce one's attachment to the self. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.